The glass of water on the side table has a single perfect lemon wedge floating at the top. It has been there for 6 hours. The pulp is starting to fray. White fibers drifting like tiny jellyfish in the stillness of the room. The air conditioning in the estate is silent. A pressurized coolness that smells of expensive floor wax and old bound scripts. Outside the floor-to-ceiling windows, the pine trees of the valley are black against a graying sky. There is no wind. The heavy velvet curtains are pulled back just enough to show the distance between the house and the gate. The gate is 3 miles down a private gravel road. The keys to the Range Rover are on the kitchen island, buried under a stack of high-gloss headshots. He sits in the wing-back chair, his legs crossed at the ankle. He is wearing a cashmere sweater the color of oatmeal. He hasn't raised his voice once. He hasn't touched me since the initial handshake. He simply watches. A leather-bound notebook open on his knee, a silver fountain pen resting in the crease. The silence is a physical weight, a soft blanket pressed over my face until the rhythm of my own breathing sounds like an intrusion. It's about trust, Elena. That's what he said when the car service dropped me off. Not the trust between a director and an actress, but the trust between the character and the abyss. He told me that most performers are cowards. They want the applause without the flaying. They want to play the victim without ever feeling the cold steel of the hook. He said he saw something different in my eyes during the first callback. He saw a hunger that didn't know its own name. He called it a gift. He called it a burden. I agreed to the weekend because the role is the kind that defines a decade. A broken heiress. A woman who dismantles her own life piece by piece until there is nothing left but the raw architecture of her ego. It required immersion, he said. Total transparency. I packed a small bag and left my phone in the glove box of my car back at the agency lot, just like he asked. Disconnect to reconnect. It sounded like a mantra. It sounded like a prayer. Now, looking at that lemon wedge, it sounds like a door locking. The first 12 hours were academic. We sat in the library and tore the script apart. He asked me about my father. Not the man, but the shadow he left behind. He asked me about the first time I realized that my beauty was a currency, and the exact moment I realized that currency was devaluing. He spoke with a clinical detachment that made me want to lean in, to prove that I was brave enough to handle the scrutiny. Every time I reached a point of discomfort, he would smile, a small, tired movement of his lips, and tell me we could stop. He offered me the exit every 20 minutes. He made the door seem so wide open that it felt like a failure to walk through it. By the second day, the house felt smaller. The architecture hadn't changed, but the way he moved through it had. He was always in the periphery. If I went to the kitchen for coffee, he was already there, rinsing a spoon. If I went to the balcony for air, he was in the garden below, looking up. He never called my name. He waited for me to acknowledge him. It was a game of gravitational pull, and I was the smaller body, caught in his orbit. The hunger is what kept me in the chair. It wasn't just the role anymore. It was the need to be seen by someone who claimed to see everything. He had stripped away the artifice of the industry, the fake smiles and the empty praise, and replaced it with a terrifying, focused attention. He made me feel like the only person in the world who was truly awake. To leave would be to go back to being a ghost, a face in a crowd of 1,000 girls with the same blonde hair and the same desperate eyes. Here, under the surgical light of his interest, I was real, even if it hurt. The anchor of normalcy was the coffee. He made it every morning at 7 a.m., the sound of the beans grinding was the only thing that broke the silence. The smell of the dark roast, the heavy ceramic mugs, the way the steam rose in the cold morning air. It felt like home. It felt like safety. As long as there was coffee, we were just two professionals working on a craft. As long as the kitchen was clean and the mugs were matched, nothing bad could be happening. It was the logic of a child, but I clung to it. I watched him pour the milk, watched the white swirl into the black, and told myself that a man who cares about the temperature of the milk isn't a man to be feared. Then came the rehearsal for the third act, the breaking point. We were in the drawing room. The sun was setting, casting long orange daggers across the hardwood. He told me to stand in the center of the room. He told me to take off my shoes. The floor was cold. He told me that the character had lost her pride. Not her clothes, not her money, but the very idea that she deserved to be treated with respect. "Tell me you're nothing," he said. He wasn't looking at me. He was writing in his notebook. I said the lines. I whispered them at first. Then I spoke them with the practiced projection of a theater vet. "No," he said, his voice flat. "Not the lines, the truth." I stood there, my toes curling against the wood. I felt the heat rising in my neck. I felt the absurdity of the situation, the way the late afternoon light made everything look like a painting. I thought about the keys on the kitchen island. I thought about the 3-mile walk to the gate. I could leave. I could put my shoes on, walk out the front door, and never look back. But if I left, I would be proving him right. I would be the coward. I would be the girl who couldn't handle the abyss. And the role, the career, the life I had imagined would vanish with the dust motes dancing in the light. "I'm nothing," I said. He finally looked up. His eyes were dark, unreadable. He didn't move. He didn't applaud. He just waited. The silence stretched until it became a scream. I found myself wanting to fill it. I found myself wanting to give him more, just to make the pressure stop. I began to talk about things I hadn't thought about in years. Failures. Shames. Small, sharp cruelties I had endured and inflicted. I offered them up like sacrifices on an altar. He didn't stop me. He watched me unravel with the steady, patient gaze of a scientist observing a reaction. The exit mirage happened that night. After the rehearsal, he told me I was brilliant. He told me I had found the heart of the character. He poured me a glass of wine and sat on the sofa, leaving a space beside him. He told me the car would be here at noon the next day. He told me the part was mine. I felt a surge of triumph so intense it made my hands shake. I had done it. I had survived the gauntlet. I had won. I sat down beside him, the wine warm in my throat, the tension in my shoulders finally beginning to dissolve. We talked about the shoot, the locations, the costuming. He spoke to me like a partner, a collaborator. He touched my hand, a brief reassuring pressure. "I should go to bed," I said, smiling. "I'm exhausted." "Of course," he said. "But first we need to finalize the contract. Not the paper one, the internal one." He stood up and walked to the door. He didn't lock it. He just stood in front of it, his hand resting lightly on the frame. He looked at me, and the warmth was gone. It had been replaced by a terrifying clarity. "The heiress doesn't just lose her pride, Elena. She loses her memory of what it felt like to have it. She doesn't just say yes because she has to. She says yes because she no longer knows how to say no." I looked at the window. The reflection of the room was layered over the darkness outside. I saw myself sitting on the sofa, the wine glass in my hand. I looked small. I looked fragile. I looked like something that could be broken and glued back together in a different shape. The failure point was the moment I didn't get up. I could have stood. I could have walked to the door and asked him to move. He was older than me, smaller than me. I could have pushed past him. But the weight of the last 48 hours, the slow erosion of my own internal boundaries, the hunger to be the woman he wanted me to be, it all combined into a leaden paralysis. I sat there, the lemon wedge in the water glass across the room mocking me with its slow decay. "Show me," he said. "Show me how she says yes when she wants to scream." I didn't scream. I didn't even flinch. I felt the logic of the weekend take its final, predatory hold. If I fought now, everything I had given him, the secrets, the tears, the pride, would be for nothing. It would be a waste. I had already paid so much. To stop now would be to lose the investment. It was the sunk cost fallacy of the soul. I put the wine glass down on the coffee table. The muffled thud of the crystal against the wood sounded like a gavel. "Yes," I said. The word didn't sound like mine. It sounded like something he had taught me to say. a script I had memorized without realizing I was auditioning for my own disappearance. He didn't move from the door. He didn't have to. The walls of the estate were no longer made of stone and wood. They were made of my own justifications. I stood up and walked toward him. My feet were still bare. The floor was still cold. He didn't smile. He didn't need to. He had seen the hunger, and he had fed it until it was fat and heavy, until it was the only thing left of me. The next morning, the coffee smelled the same. The beans ground with the same rhythmic crunch. The sun hit the kitchen island, illuminating the keys to the Range Rover. They were still there. I could see them from the doorway. I could reach out and take them. I could drive down the 3-mile road, through the gate, and back to the world where people used feeling words and phones buzzed with meaningless notifications. I sat at the table and waited for him to pour the milk. I watched the white swirl into the black. I watched the steam rise. I didn't look at the keys. I didn't look at the gate. I looked at the silver fountain pen resting on the counter. "We have work to do," he said, his voice as smooth as the oatmeal cashmere of his sweater. I picked up my mug. The ceramic was warm, a comforting weight in my palm. I took a sip. It was perfect. "Yes," I said. The car service arrived at noon. I watched it from the window. The driver got out and stood by the hood, checking his watch. He looked like a man from another planet, a man who lived in a world where choices were simple, and the air didn't taste of lemon and floor wax. "Are you coming?" he asked from the hallway. I looked at my reflection in the glass. The blonde hair was the same. The blue eyes were the same. But the expression was different. It was the expression of someone who had found the abyss and decided to stay. Not because she was trapped, but because she no longer remembered the way out. "I'm coming," I said. I walked out the front door. The air was sharp and smelled of pine. I didn't look back at the house. I didn't look at the man standing in the shadows of the foyer. I climbed into the back of the car and closed the door. The click of the latch was the loudest sound I had ever heard. As we drove down the gravel road, the tires crunching over the stones, I looked at my hands. They were steady. They were calm. I was a professional. I was an actress. I was the woman who had won the role of a lifetime. By the time we reached the gate, I had forgotten what it felt like to want to leave. The hunger had been replaced by a cold, hollowed-out satisfaction. I was his creation now, a vessel for his vision, a character in a story that hadn't even begun to be written. The driver caught my eye in the rearview mirror. "Good weekend?" he asked. I looked out the window at the passing trees, the black pines and the gray sky. I thought about the lemon wedge, fraying in the water. I thought about the keys on the island. I thought about the word yes and how it tasted like copper and silk. "It was exactly what I needed," I said. The car turned onto the highway, and the estate disappeared behind a curve in the road. I leaned my head back against the leather seat and closed my eyes. The silence was still there, tucked inside my chest, a dark, quiet room where the door was always open, and I was always sitting in the chair, waiting for the next instruction.